back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams, and the show is sponsored by Richard Sage over there at savageclassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. Richard will hook you up with the guitar of your dreams. Just tell him I sent you. That's savageclassical.com. Also, rosettapodcast.com/insider. Sorry about the long URL, but I'm just not popular enough to... just get you guys over there and get paid for it. So you guys got to enter the whole URL in order for me to see a dime. That's rosettapodcast.com/insider for access to Rosetta Stone for as little as $9 a month. You can get a rolling subscription and you can learn one language of your choice, or for a couple $100, you get a lifetime membership and access to all the languages. That's rosettapodcast.com/insider. And savageclassical.com, of course, our longest running sponsor. I hope everything's okay. If you want to sponsor the show, please reach out to me. I get emails every week from you guys and from your publicists and from people who don't even play guitar asking me if I would like to talk about their projects. And of course I would. It's a very, very small fee. It's not that much money to get your project talked about. Of course, if you are rich and famous, it'll be more. And if you're poor and young, it'll be less. So just give me an email. Shoot me at Brett@BrettWilliamsMusic.com. That's Brett@BrettWilliamsMusic.com for advertising packages. All right. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I'm having to leave town for the first time for Thanksgiving in 4 years, I think. Am I right about that? Maybe longer? I don't know. I don't feel like I've gone. I'm going up to Boston area with the girlfriend, old Liz there, and we're going to, do the whole family Thanksgiving thing. And I'm just going to try and manage gout and stay out of trouble and not gain too much weight. But that's not a big deal. Just take it off afterwards. Is this interesting? Gout and weight gain? I'm going to do that and take a breather. I don't think I'm going to bring the guitar up with me. I've been heavy at it. I had my first, all you guys have been playing. I mean, my friends have been playing out for a while, but I haven't. But I played with a singer the other night and it was fun. I got to a party. I got kind of hired to do this gig with a friend's mother who was a Broadway singer. Her name's Zora. And she was just a real joy to work with, especially in the rehearsal. It was really fun. Singing with somebody. She's an older person. And there's just so much depth to her sound and to her rubato. It was really fun to do. I hadn't really worked with a singer in a long time. My old friend Brett from Manus and I used to do things together, but that was about it. Maybe Becca. I don't know if we ever did anything. But I don't work with singers all the time. I know you guys work with singers all the time because you marry them. Everybody's married to their singer partner, right? I don't know why that makes me laugh. It's just I always see these guitarists with these with these hot singers. And I'm just thinking, like, did the singer think that, like, oh, this is cool, now I have an accompanist for the rest of my life? Because it's kind of true. I'm not saying it's solicitation. just saying, if you married a singer, chances are that's probably what you're going to be doing with the majority of your time as an artist. And I feel for you. I personally would not like to do that. That would drive me insane. Of course, there are people that do a great job at it. Olson Dukari, we just had on the show this year. No big deal for them. They seem to be getting along great. For me, I would want to kill her. I dated a singer in college, and it was okay. But, it's really hard when you have two people having a meltdown before a concert. That to me would compound it. I remember Amy, who I dated for a long time in college, in undergrad, was actually, I knew her from high school. She was a high school sweetheart, and she was a mezzo, and she still is absolutely an amazing singer. And what's great is I met up with her last two Christmases ago, and it was so great because we were both in exactly the same place. We're both, like, you know, teaching a lot of children. We're still, you know, focused on the right projects. We're not just like gigging musicians. We're really, you know, we're very in tune with what we want artistically. And, you know, we had like real high standards with that. And it was just great. It was great, you know, meeting up with her again. Anyway, I hadn't seen her in, I think, like 20 years. It was exciting. So, and since we've been in touch. So anyway, I remember we did a recital once, and it was just like she wanted a massage and I wanted a massage, and she needed a sandwich and I wanted pasta, or vice versa. Or she needed this on her sandwich and I needed this on my sandwich. We were sitting there and we were just fueling each other's anxiety. And I'm sure that, you know, as singers and guitarists, you guys can work through that. And I'm only saying this because I just dealt with the anxiety on Saturday night with Zora. It was, first of all, I got hired. Now, I didn't charge that much money. It's like a friend. So it was just like a, you know, thing. And of course, like all these things, right? Right? Every time I take on a project, it's like people, I remember she said, God bless her, but Zora goes, this will be easy. It's never easy. To learn us, even in easy, I mean, you know, if you're going to play a Beatles song that we all know, that's one thing. You know, yeah, I'll do that at a, hand me the guitar, you know. But if, you know, you want me to learn a song that I'm unaware of, that's like a jazz song, it was kind of a new agey song, it's called Get Here. And you want me to execute it, I probably should memorize it. I was moving my capo all over the place during a rehearsal. I just bought a new capo, and this isn't a plug, this is like off the, but D'Addario, who is a sponsor of mine, has a capo now that I think it's called like the Pro, and it's small and no buzzes. I'm not even playing. They should, I should have hit them up for this because I actually, you know, it's great. I'm telling you, because I've always had capos and they're either big or stupid or, yeah, but these, it has like some sort of material on the pad, you know, the part that touches the strings, that really just, it's very sweet sounding. It like tonally, it's like the first capo I've used that actually like focuses on making sure that you're maintaining some semblance of tone. Anyway, so this capo is great. Yeah, the D'Addario Pro. It's a small black one. Anyway, the material that they use on that pad, pretty sweet. And luckily I had it. I just got it, I think like a month ago. I don't know why. I think I was ordering some strings and I was like, I threw that in just to check it out. But anyway, so, you know, moved that to the old third fret there. All right. And played with Zora. And like I said, it's not easy. You know, these people think we just do this. We just, what do you call it? Spirit. These interpretations and arrangements into fruition, and they're just you know, they don't understand. So you know, that was my week, and also it was my first performance in a really long time, so I was really you know, I knew I wasn't scared, but I knew I would be, and I needed to be prepared. So the visualization came into play. I'm sorry, I just remember that I hadn't told you that Steve Mattingly is going to be on the show. He is a great guy. He's a sweetheart. He's part of the Tantalus Quartet. He is the associate professor of music at the University of Louisville. And he is a great president. He has a farm. So we had a nice little interview. I'm sorry I didn't put that into the head. Steven's great. I hope we're lifelong friends. I don't know if I was sick that day or what. I was a little off for this interview. You know, I'm not doing these all the time. And like I said, something about having a roommate makes it where it's harder to sort of, especially with the intros, it's harder for me just to like free up and relax and sort of just be myself, because I know that someone's listening, or at least they don't want to be listening, or they're trying not to listen anyway. So I did the performance, and then, you know, it's supposed to be a party. I knew where the party was because I had dated her daughter. So I knew her daughter's apartment, and I knew the layout of it. It's two floors, you know, it's nice enough. And I was like, oh, this won't be a big deal. Anyway, it's like 60 people there. And that's if you play a lot, you know that that's the sweet spot. That's where you start going like, okay. Whew. But at the same time, I don't know. Sometimes I have a hard time playing. It doesn't matter. And also, the worst part was there were a lot of friends there. So that was that was like the nightmare. And it wasn't a hard piece, but I just was like, so what did I do? I had these old expired beta blockers, right? And I pop one of these things. Once I see what's going on, you know, it's about 8:30 and I start seeing people just kind of, oh, it's getting crowded now. And also not to mention COVID, you know, like, you know, I don't know, just haven't been in a big crowded room like that for a while with a bunch of people I don't know. So, but they're all good people. I'm not saying good people can't get COVID. So anyway, I pop the pill. And I don't know if it was because it was expired or I just haven't been used to it or whatever, but I did that and I started to feel, and I took a sip of whiskey. We were standing around, we were supposed to go on at 9:30, we go on at 11, go on, you know, whatever. I'm making a big deal out of this, but it was, you know, it was, to me, it was like, you know, the first time my girlfriend had really seen me play. It was, you know, it was silly. I wasn't even playing my music. But, yeah, I did that, and then I, you know, had like a sip of whiskey, and whoa, I was just like in another dimension. It's like tripping balls. So that's what happened. But then I sat down and I was right in my element. I was having fun with it, and it was great. It was no big deal. So anyway, that was a nice little ramble for you guys, right? Kind of all over the place. Talked about my plans for Thanksgiving. Talked about performing again post-COVID. It's going to happen. I can feel it. I'm close. I've got the rep now. I've got like enough solo rep to, you know, do a performance, I think. Something about 50 minutes worth. Pad that with some talk. Right? You know, out there. Like I said, if you guys want to contribute to the show, go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. If you do it and you have something you want to plug, let me know. And give me the details on it, okay? And we'll make it happen. It's worth it. Trust me. A lot of people listen to this show. You know, or as much as the classical music world is going to allow for. But I appreciate you for listening. Here's my time with Stephen Mattingly.
Yeah, we were talking about my role with the Board of Trustees for the Guitar Foundation of America and the bylaws and policy documents for the nonprofit is written in a way that you have a 3-year term on the board, which can be renewed. And in my case, I was renewed for a second term. And then at the end of that second 3-year term, the bylaws are written in a way that where you have to be off the board for at least a year. And my term expired at the end of 2020. So I've been this year looking at the GFA from the outside, looking in, which is a great place to be because I've had some role in the GFA since 2006.
Wow.
I started in 2006. I was a volunteer at the convention that was held in Columbus, Georgia, at Andrew Zone's place. Mm-hmm. And then the following year, I joined as a staff member in 2007. And then from there on, I have had some role with the GFA until this year, essentially.
And what, you know, as far as who enacts those bylaws, where do those bylaws come from? Do you guys create those as a board, or is that something that's sort of a nonprofit conglomerate situation where they push that on you, or is that sort of just a model that you guys have adopted from other similar institutions?
Yeah, that all predates my time with the organization, and I think it's largely due in great part to Martha Masters and Brian Head, who took over some leadership role of the GFA in the early 2000s. And I I know that a charter for any nonprofit is required when you file with a state agency to be a nonprofit organization. So there were documents prior to the early 2000s, but the current ones, I think, you know, this is really getting into the history of the organization, maybe like 2010 or somewhere around in there, the kind of the first edition of what they have now. And those are reviewed and revised every couple years very carefully. And I think it's just a matter of responsibility of an agency to make sure that there's the turnover in the board to bring in fresh ideas and fresh talent. That's something that I think if there's, of all of the things that I did as president of that board that were mostly thanks to what everyone else was doing, the only thing I think that I may have had some small contribution in is bringing on new members of the board and new fresh ideas and a perspective that would help with the growth and overall longevity of the organization.
What do you see? I mean, you know, being involved in that organization, and it's... I have mixed feelings about the GFA. I think it's great because it, from a preservationist standpoint, you know, it's definitely the place to go, maybe in the world right now, for an organized, you know, effort to make sure that the classical guitar has funding, that it has, you know, that you guys are providing the biggest guitar competition in the world, all right. That stuff. But what do you think the GFA can do? Exciting ideas are you guys throwing around there?
Yeah, I think, well, and they're no longer my ideas. They're the great ideas of the current board and the administration and the staff there. You know, the executive director, Connie Hsu, has a lot of projects that she oversees along with Martha and Brian.
Right.
And I would say so anyone who has a notion of what the GFA is, especially... say from our generation and earlier, our association might be the Soundboard magazine that would come in the mail. And I know for myself, I've subscribed to that since the early 90s. And it's kind of like I would be aware of the GFA for a month while I, you know, thumbed through the magazine. And then it was out of sight, out of mind until the convention rolled around. So these days, there's the website there and a lot of YouTube content with their TV series, the GFA TV series they have on YouTube. I would recommend that just go poke around the website and look at what's up. There's a lot of really exciting stuff going on with their mentorship project, the initiatives they have with that to work toward better equity, inclusion, and diversity. There's a lot of great pedagogical content for people at all levels in their series on YouTube. So
that's good. That's exciting.
Yeah.
As far as like your sort of journey with that, you said you joined, what'd you say, 2006? You said you started with that. What sort of was the impetus to become part of that organization? Did you ever compete in it? Did you ever do it?
That's one competition I never competed and lost in. I definitely had sights on something like that, but at that time, when I was a younger student, there wasn't a youth competition associated with it, at least not that my teachers made me aware of. They probably knew I would go lose and fail miserably. But I just thought, you know, this isn't for me right now. Yeah. And I was competing in competitions at different levels. But what got me initially involved in the GFA was really a lot thanks to my good friend, my dear friend and colleague, Matt Cochran. And Matt was doing some work with the GFA. And he said, "Hey, man, I told the GFA you would volunteer for them." And I was like, "Oh, well, fantastic." He's like, "Yeah, you got a call with them next week. They're going to call you about some stuff." And so I said, "Okay, fantastic. Let's see what this entails." And so Matt got me hooked up with the GFA, and then it was great, you know, great time from there on.
So you're from Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
Matthew Cochran's from Pennsylvania. How do I know Matthew Cochran? I don't see. This is the problem with people our age is that things happened 25 years ago, and now you can't remember where you I can't remember.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and also, you know, we meet each other and run in these circles during guitar competitions and festivals where we're, running a mile a minute, and then you try to compress all of that into
right.
a day's activity and remember. But yeah, so I am from Louisville, Kentucky, where I am teaching now at the University of Louisville. And I actually went to, the funny thing about that, I went to school right across the street at a performing arts high school where I majored in piano, that they didn't have a guitar program then. And this office that I'm sitting in right now is where I had my very first classical guitar lesson.
You've got to be kidding. That's incredible. Crazy. That's kind of, you know, yeah. I think that more of us should do that. You know, I didn't do that. I could have gone back to Stockton and figured things out, but you...
Yeah, you're from California, right?
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's like little positions there, but I think that's really cool that you started in, I mean, Louisville's got to be a great place to live. I mean, you love living there?
Oh, I
you're
love
from
it.
There?
I,
you got all I'm your friends there? Here.
Yeah, yeah. And,
lucky.
And I'm really lucky. I'm so, so lucky. And my wife and I just bought a family farm, a farm that's been in my family since the 1960s. We have a little piece of land there, and my uncle and cousin are right next door. It's really great. And
what do you got going out of the farm? What are you gonna make? Some cheese or some bread?
Yeah, in fact, we are. Yeah. So, what came about was, my mother was doing the retirement thing and moving to Florida. And, I called up my wife and said, "Hey, you want to quit that day job you have and become a farmer?" And she said, "Yes, can I leave right now?"
What was her day job?
She was an importer exporter. She was doing compliance with mugs and stuff and all this horrible stuff. Like she hated it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was soul sucking for her. And then so now she's a full-time farmer, and we have a herd of goats and chickens and a massive garden. We just had our pepper harvest, and I think there were like half a dozen big buckets, like, you know, baskets and buckets of like 5 gallon size that she had full of all kinds of hot peppers, everything you could imagine. And so we do we do goat milk and raise dairy goats there. And that's what I go home to.
That's a great combo. Teaching. A great combo on a piece of toast is goat and pepper. There you go.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And put an egg on that, a farm fresh egg on top of that. Oh, it's to die for. It's great.
What is the, whose farm was that? That was your family farm? That was like your grandma's, grandma's?
Yeah. Grandpa, my grandfather bought that in the mid 60s. And at that time, it's south of Louisville. It was countryside there, but now everything's coming in on it. You know, we've got neighborhoods all around us and whatnot. So
all the cool kids are in there now, right? I'd imagine.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, our dream for that is to, you know, we're very, very much about permaculture, which is an interesting aspect of farming where you try to make the minimal impact you possibly can on the land from, you know, an industrial perspective.
How do you do that? Well, the simplest example would be like rotating crops, right?
Right, rotating crops, and also trying not to do things that are very much like the monocrop culture that we have, where you
monocrop? That sounds cool.
Well, like
I want to know about it.
Yeah, like if you drive across the Midwest and you see, you know, mile upon mile of corn and nothing but corn, and then they'll rotate that to soybeans, and you have nothing but soybeans for the far as the eye can see. Those things are a practice of the industrial age and not the way we would typically farm in centuries prior. And it turns out not the way that's healthiest for Mother Earth either, because it doesn't, there are things that will fix the soil to bring nutrients back into the soil. And if you have the same crop year after year, it depletes the soil of many of those nutrients. And in fact, the crops will eventually fail and be susceptible to different pests and whatnot.
Congratulations. I mean, this all sounds like so much fun.
Great. It's a lot of fun.
So let's just get, you are in your hometown, which is a great town.
Yeah.
You know, did you, when you left, you said you studied with Dale Kavanaugh for a second.
I did.
Where did you do that?
I think she mentioned, as you know, I am a fan of the show, so right.
I listened to his episodes.
Yeah. So you recently had Dale on, like a few months ago. Yeah. So she mentioned she teaches at the Hochschule für Musik Detmold, and I studied with her technically at that university, but at the time she was teaching at a location in Dortmund, which is about an hour's drive or so from Cologne, for those who know Germany. It's about an hour's drive northeast-ish from Cologne. Dortmund is. And so I did, essentially the degree I did there is equivalent to what we here would, in our degree plan, call a master's, but the curriculum looks more like an artist diploma. Yeah.
But did you ever get to work with any of her pieces, any of those preludes or anything?
I didn't. She was doing that composing and whatnot
right.
about the same time when I was there. I went there after I did my undergrad and master's at Eastman with Nick Alousis. And, you know, obviously that was an amazing experience. And I left Eastman and going to Dale at just the right time and the right combination of factors to get to Europe. And I would say that the notion of playing her pieces never really occurred to me, and she didn't bring it up.
She's unassuming is the thing.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
As absolutely. Most, yeah. You know, really great composers and performers seem to be.
Right. The thing my own impression of her music when I hear it is I hear Dale, her as a person, and her great spirit and character really comes through in her music. It seems very genuine and honest to me. I can't help but hear her music and smile and just get excited about it. So I've not played her music, but I've taught it. So some of my students have brought her music in and wanted to study it. And I'm like, oh yeah, let's do this. Let's do some preludes.
Yeah, there's no reason not to. I mean,
there's
no reason that everybody needs to play just the Villa-Lobos and then,
oh, of course,
you know, that's what they play until they're 30.
Right.
And then we all wake up from that dream and say, oh, is there anything else to play? And they're like, yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe there is. You're going to have to go find it on your own, kid. So
right.
That's great. We're, you know, like, yeah, spreading the word. But, you know, as far as like, that is an incredible education, actually. Nick Alousis to Dale Cavanaugh, you know, to Germany, all that stuff. I mean, that's a pretty, you couldn't, if you were a calculating person, you couldn't have come up with a better plan, I think. That's.
Yeah, it worked out.
How did you
really
decide to study with her? What was, I mean, was it, did you take a master class? Did you see?
Well, I met her and her husband, Thomas Kirchhoff, who is himself a great teacher. I had some lessons with him during my time in Germany. And Thomas is normally known for his work hosting the Iserlohn Guitar Festival. At least that's our awareness here in the U.S. But I had some excellent lessons with him, formally in a sense of a lesson setting, but also just by sitting back and observing what he does as an artist and as an arranger and an organizer of events. So in undergrad, I applied for a grant to do a project with the Arts Leadership Program at Eastman, which is now a whole institute. It's a really interesting program. And the suggestion from this professor was to contact someone who you wouldn't ever imagine would say yes to you acting as their assistant. So I said, okay, let's do that. So I called up Steve Thatchek, Canadian guitarist who's out in LA teaching at Northridge now. And at the time he was kind of my mentor as a teaching assistant at Eastman. And he said, well, why don't you call my friend Thomas Kirchhoff in Germany and see what he's doing? And so I made two phone calls, and they were, kids, phone calls, not emails, not Snapchats or whatever.
Yeah, right.
I picked up the phone and I called Europe.
100%.
Yeah,
that's what you did.
Yeah. And so I talked to Thomas and I talked to Oscar Gilia. And I had studied with Oscar in Siena for 2 years previous. And I proposed this to both of them, and they each said, well, I can't pay you. What does this cost? And I said, well, that's the great thing. This grant would pay me. So you don't have to pay for anything. can I just come along and see what's happening there and act as an assistant in some way? And I was assistant for the summer to Oscar in Siena and then to Thomas in Iserlohn. And it was through that experience that I really met Dale for the first time.
Wow, that so you're getting things done. We're about the same age. Are you mid-40s or something?
Yeah, I'm 43 as we talk at
the end
of
October. We are exactly the same age. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, you just turned 43?
No, I turned 44 in a couple months.
Okay, here we go. When is your birthday?
December 3rd.
Okay, good.
I share my birthday with Ozzy Osbourne.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Do you like Ozzy Osbourne?
Oh, man, yeah. That was so. We haven't talked about the beginnings of guitar, but you know my studies in guitar, and that's where that things really got started. Is I got one of those thick books of all the tabs of Randy Rhoads, and I sat there trying to figure that out with an electric guitar.
That's what it is. It's sort of a love for tinkering.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a great way to put it. Yeah, tinkering. That's exactly what I was doing.
Yeah, exactly. And then eventually you're like, I think I have to learn how to read music or
that's
I'm never going to really figure this shit out.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. You're going to be functionally illiterate until you figure out what all of this is, putting it together.
Yeah, I do. And I think that the world would be different. I think the whole world would be different if the musicians that we were listening to really knew how to read music.
Oh, sure. Well, and you know, I'm not saying that as a snob for those who read tablature. Because
I'm just saying it'd be different, not better. I don't know.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, I think it's, you know, having everything kind of, you know, having pop music be so idiomatic to the guitar and not really be part of like a greater sort of narrative. I don't know. That's just, that's one of my little stupid thoughts. But, you know, as far as your background, did your dad play, mom play, anybody get you started on it? Or was it just, you were just... Like most people our age, you started just, wanting to be a rock, not a rock star, but you just wanted to play guitar. You wanted to play guitar well. You wanted to own a pretty guitar and play it well.
No, I wanted to be a rock star.
You wanted to be a rock star.
No, I got started because my mom had a guitar. She didn't, you know, from her childhood. And I got to dragging that thing out and then tinkering with that and whatnot led to, you know, years later after... You know, begging for guitar lessons. My parents finally got me some lessons.
What kind of guitar was it? Was it a classical one or?
A steel string. Yeah. It was a steel string. So I was, you know, speaking of tinkering, I was putting that thing into some wacky tunings and just wailing on that. I can't imagine, you know, what kind of Harry Parch kind of stuff I was creating at that time.
Dude, discovering open tuning when you're like 12, you're just like, why haven't I been doing this the entire time?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's how it got started. And then from there, it was, you know, really the piano is what got me to classical guitar.
I find that the people that play piano, you know, make the best young guitarists, at least, you know, I mean, you know, they just sort of naturally, Giacomo, who I played with, started with piano, and everybody I know who's really, really good has a lot of experience on that instrument. And so that was your story as well, a little bit. Really helps with note reading and just sort of sight reading and jumping into things and not taking 20 years to learn a prelude and all that stuff.
Absolutely. And I think back to like my, you know, my first teacher, the one that was teaching me here, Richard Goring was my teacher then. He's out of Cincinnati, great teacher. And he was doing a lot for me to lay some strong technical foundations. And I think what the background in piano led to is a kind of a shortcut to note reading. So I was skipping all of what most people would be doing at the time in the, you know, the late 80s, early 90s of going through Charles Duncan or Fred Note or whatever method they might be doing. I was kind of skipping all of the note reading aspects and going straight to playing full pieces, which I guess that this is my, you know, my own fault. I jumped into that stuff, not really taking the time to grasp the technical foundations quite as well as I think someone who might be forced to do that might have experienced.
Right.
So,
that's an interesting perspective.
You know, when I think about teaching my own students, I kind of think back to my teaching and the things that I didn't do well as a student at that time to try to figure out how I might cast that for them now. Because I know for sure Richard was trying to give me the best technical foundations he could, and I was adopting what I was, but probably playing pieces that were a little too hard for me by my.
Well, it's exciting when you're a teacher and you have a kid that's good. That's just sort of naturally good. You kind of want to get them going, and then you're not really looking at that thumb or that wrist or that other stuff.
Richard did that. He made sure I was doing. Yeah, he was fixing all that stuff. I the interesting thing is, like, when I look back to those days and the lessons I'm teaching here, I have a color pencil in the studio that he used with me as a student. The same one was in the desk here, sitting in the desk. It's kind of funny.
And you have it.
I have it. Yeah, I now have stopped using it as much because I'm on an iPad and I email my students their scores.
There's like, I think we went through this thing sort of culturally here where, there was a good 15, 20 year period where it was really cool to sort of feng shui everything out. You know, you put everything in a pile and you throw out the things that don't serve you. And now I'm kind of left with nothing. I don't mm-hmm. have any of that stuff. I don't have anything.
Right. Yeah.
And, my ex-girlfriend is sitting there cleaning out her mom's basement, and she found a tax return of mine from like 1999. And I was just like, oh, yeah. And she's like, do you want it? And I was like, I think I do. I was like, I don't really have anything. Like, I don't have any of my old stuff. I'm just so, I was so just like, get rid of it, get rid of it, get rid of it. But it's like now you get older and you're like looking at an old pencil and you're like, that's the one.
Yeah.
That's the
pencil. Yeah. I guess I'm a little nostalgic for those kinds of things too,
Sentimental. As we get closer to the great unknown.
That's right. Yeah.
And as far as sort of your relationship with what institution are you at right now mostly? University of Louisville?
100%. I'm 100% at the University of Louisville School of Music, which is right here in downtown Louisville, and we are at the edge of the nation's largest Victorian neighborhood.
Oh,
beautiful,
God.
Beautiful homes.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. It is the largest contiguous collection of Victorian homes.
See, that's my favorite thing about Los Angeles. The only thing I really like about Los Angeles is walking through the neighborhoods. I just love houses.
Yeah.
And I feel creepy because I am just walking around these little, but I just love walking around and seeing sort of homogenous houses, it's non-cookie cutter houses, what they're called.
Oh, right.
So any kind, even if it's any sort of architecture, anything sort of pre-1950, it's just, man, I'm all about it. And that's,
oh sure,
that's where you're at. It's the largest,
right?
One
right.
of those.
And it is the largest. And a lot of my students are fortunate that they have been turned in, some of them, into apartments. And so I have a student here now actually doing his master's from, he studied in LA. He's from San Diego and he's living in one of those such houses in an apartment.
Like in a student style apartment.
Yeah. Like he's got a floor, I suppose, probably of one of those there. And, we had the Kempinski duo from Poland doing a residency here for 18 mm-hmm. months and they lived in one of those houses. They had the whole third floor and balcony and everything overlooking the park. It's beautiful, really, actually.
So the university owns like a good amount of those that they can sort of help people
out. I guess they might. They might. And some of it is just affiliated stuff. Like we have some bed and breakfasts in the area where we put up guest artists frequently. And it's a nice town. And then also the historic nature of it, the Kentucky Derby is here every year. A little horse race in May. And
even know what to do about the horse race because it's like every time, isn't like the last two times the winner, they find out the winner's been, smoking crack or something like that?
Yeah. It's doping it's like doping in all sports, right? Like, what do you do about baseball? The horse is like are the Mark McGuire's of horse racing or whatever, the doping scandal.
It just seems like I think my horse won 2 years ago. And then my brother calls up and goes, no, your horse didn't win. They found. I'm like, what? It doesn't. Yeah. I don't even care.
Yeah. Well, you must have bet on Giacomo, right?
That sounds right. I think I bet on Giacomo. Because of my buddy Giacomo. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So have you ever gone to the Kentucky Derby? Do you do that?
I have. I have some mixed feelings about it. Like it's tough. It's tough to legitimize the way some trainers choose to treat those horses. Seeing the tragedy of Eight Bells was really tough to watch. Mm-hmm. I go frequently to the track, but not to the Derby itself. Because it's just, if you're a local, that's just an absolute madhouse. You usually either leave town or stay away from the track area because you're not going anywhere.
Right.
If you're stuck in that,
it's like Times Square here or South by Southwest in Austin.
Totally. Yep. That's right.
Yeah. Kentucky Derby, where you are. Yeah. You leave. But I mean, going to the actual place, it must be pretty. What's that place called? Kentucky Derby?
Churchill Downs.
Churchill Downs. That's right.
Yeah,
right.
That's where it is. Yeah. And that's just at the south end of campus. So if you're at the south end of our campus, you can look out from the baseball field and see the downs right over there.
Well, so you seem like a pretty well-rounded guy. What do you do? What do you do for fun out there? You've got this great fun town. What do you eat? Are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm not a vegetarian. I'm a big fan of a well-rounded
horse
diet of all different kinds of stuff. Yeah, horse meat. I do a lot of, the university gig keeps me pretty busy. You know, I'm right now in a phase of work where I practice from 9:30 at night until 1 in the morning, around in there.
Wow. So you're one of those night guys.
I am. I've had some great conversations about this with Jeff McFadden, that he's a night guy too. And by nature, I would be up until 3 or 4 in the morning, and my best practicing starts at 11 p.m. really. And that doesn't work well when you have to teach at 9 a.m. So I just force myself. But I have a gig coming up in the spring. I'm playing the Aranjuez with the Louisville Orchestra, so I'm busting those chops.
Oh yeah, that's cool.
So I've played the piece a few times, but getting those licks back under the fingers takes some doing for sure.
It really is. It really is. I'm working on a piece right now that's really fast.
Yeah.
And it hurts. You know, it hurts at this age. It just does. I don't want to call it age, but I'm sitting there and I'm going like, this physically hurts. Like my shoulder's killing me. You know, as far as
you were asking me what I do in town, and I'm saying, I don't have a ton of free time, but you know, the farm keeps me.
The farm keeps you busy.
It definitely. Yeah. So the great thing about that is there is, when you are working with an animal at the farm and taking your eyes off of it or not paying attention could result in a serious injury, you don't have time to worry about the stresses that had you preoccupied at work. Mm-hmm. Your mind is completely off of that. The same if you get yourself involved in a project, you know, whatever, painting a fence or something, you know, you can just bliss out and your mind can freely wander to whatever, wherever it may take you. And that's kind of my meditation and what gets me away. I'm also an avid runner. I haven't had as much time for that. I've done a few marathons and I love that.
So that's what you do. You know, you're busy with that stuff. Do you ever go to, you know, no sports, no nothing like that?
Yeah,
I mean, farm is like you getting up early. I mean, that's about that.
Yeah, some of that is definitely. But no, I'm a really big Mets fan. I love the New York Mets.
Are you serious?
Oh man,
that doesn't make any sense.
Well, think about our age. And I started collecting baseball cards and playing Little League in 1983.
There you go.
And then the Mets started to come along. Yeah. And well, in a way, even before that, you know, like with Doc and Mookie and Daryl Strawberry, all of those guys, I was just totally flipping out over what they were doing. And my dad was a big fan of the underdog. So watching those games is just absolutely, and I was just in love with them from then. So.
Yeah, I'm an underdog guy too, but man, it's been 20 years I've been living here, and it's you know, it gets tough with the Jets. I go, the Jets eventually will do it. No.
Right. No.
Never did.
No.
And the Mets, it's just, yeah, boy.
Well,
I don't know if you watched this. Did you watch this year? It was tough.
I, I could only watch a few games. It was really tough. But it was tough in the end. DeGrom started. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah.
Just watching. I mean, we were in first place the whole time, and then all of a sudden it just fell apart. And I knew when to stop watching.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now you got Houston
and story.
Atlanta going to battle. But so as far as like that, well, that's good. That's good that you're a Mets fan. You must know I'm a Mets fan too, if you listen then.
I do know you're a Mets fan, of course.
And I want to do the football thing, but I can't get behind them just sort of poaching poor people and having them beat each other brainless.
Right, you right. Know? Yeah. And you know, if you can get behind a real sport like baseball, you realize the things that matter in it, that there's no clock, which I hope we don't end up with one.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like the pitch count and clock thing that's coming in. But the fact that there is an open-ended time frame is wonderful. It's I think the best part of the sport. And it's not as confusing as like soccer, where you end up with like a time deficit or something at the end. And I don't know what they're doing at that point. You're counting down injury time or something. But it's absolutely the best sport ever invented, and I'm a big fan of it.
I can't agree with you more, and I know that we are just really on the outside with this opinion. It's just to me, it's like they made that whole, what was that, the Hank Azaria show where he's just, it's basically about the death of baseball.
Sure.
You know what I'm talking about?
I haven't.
He plays the sports announcer, Brockmeyer.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that.
Oh, God. It's good.
Okay.
But it just makes fun of baseball just being completely just like it's about to die.
Yeah.
It's so, irrelevant.
Yeah.
But I can't agree with you more. I just think it's subtle. And I think that's what I look for in just about anything. To me, it's just like it's a warm mug, a long movie.
Sure.
You know, anything slow. Mad Men was my favorite show. People are like, how could you watch The Wire and like Mad Men? I was like, it's just subtle. It's just quiet. Mm-hmm. And when something happens, when those pulses occur, it's very effective. So I am all down with a 2.5 hour baseball game.
Right.
And just waiting to see what pitch is thrown next. I'm fine
with that.
That's
right.
There seems to be less commercials, too.
Less commercials, and if you're a big fan of the sport, when you realize when you're watching that pitch, it's not a singular pitch. It's that pitch at that point in the game. Also, based on the prior experience that pitcher has had with that batter.
Right.
And so it's a historian's game, too. It's also a thinking man's game and a strategist's game. It's great.
It's great. And, you know, if you're sitting there and you're one of those people that are listening to us thinking, this is stupid, sports are stupid, I think that just like anything, that you find joy out of, you get what you put into it. So it's like the only way you're really going to like anything is to spend time with it. And
that's right.
And that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, I like that you do that. Then you can watch Essex. See, I can't watch in-game, in-market games without getting cable.
There are ways around that. won't go there.
VPN?
Called? Right. Yeah.
So as far as guitar is concerned, you did the GFA. We talked a little bit about that at the beginning. It might get edited out because of sound trouble, but let's talk. So you're in Germany.
Yep.
You study with Dale Cavanaugh. You come back here. What happens after that?
Well, I finished my degree in Germany and did a doctorate at Florida State with Bruce Holtzman. Mm-hmm. And that was part of a longer plan that had been, on my mind for years. I think I had my first lesson with Bruce when I was like 15 or something like that.
Yeah.
So I kind of by design wanted to come back to the States to do a doctorate, though by the time I was finishing my degrees in Germany, I could have conceivably stayed there and worked and been a part of that scene. But my thought was, if I ever one day may want to have a career based in the United States, it'd probably be good to get a terminal degree here. So I went that route.
Absolutely.
And that
go
was
where you're going to live,
sure,
for that
sure.
advanced degree. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a phenomenal experience with Bruce there at Tallahassee. So he was working with me, from a perspective of someone who was pretty much finished with their development as far as who they would be as a guitarist. So his work of forming the hands and all of that stuff was kind of dealing with where I was at that place. So that was a really interesting way to look at the teaching that he provided me, was having formed my hands for whatever they were, for better or worse. So we were working on a lot of things that were at a higher level perspective in graduate work, of course. So
what was he? So just interpretation?
Yeah. And also you're talking about playing fast. I'm not a fast player. And Dale did a lot for my hands. That was amazing work that we did. And I feel like it just, in many ways, wasn't long enough time with her. So Bruce, I can remember giving me ideas of just kind of, I guess, focusing my attention on specific things that needed correction and working on them at a deeper level. I can recall being there, if you're familiar with Tallahassee, at his office at Florida State. There's a TA office right next door. And I would be there in the morning waiting to teach my first lessons and practicing, and look up, and there's Bruce in the window looking in at your hands. And there's something about his pedagogy that Bruce can just look at your hands and you play better, or realize what you're not doing well, let's say,
right,
and what needs to be corrected, you know. I remember a few occasions that look of,
right,
yeah, curiosity about why exactly you're doing something, let's say.
Curiosity, I've never heard it described that way. Rather than just inflicting terror upon you. I studied with Adam, so it's the same sort of thing of just like, didn't I tell you not to do that? Why are you doing that?
And, right.
You know, you don't really know until you teach how frustrating it is.
Right.
When you've
right.
told somebody to do something.
Absolutely.
More than three times, and they're still sitting there doing
right.
it the way right. you told them not to do it.
Right. Yeah, that's everyone, of course, has Bruce stories and quotes and so forth. But the kind of thing that I just remember generally in what we were doing, you know, he would have moments where he would look at the score a second and then look at me and then say, you know, that's a B flat. and just think, well, you're right, Bruce, it is. And I'm not playing a B flat there. Let's do that.
How do you deal with your students these days? Do you think that there's a sort of a, do you think that kind of tough love flies these days? I don't know what Adam, what his approach is. I'm assuming that everybody has softened, you know, because I just know that I soften as I get older. So I'm assuming that, you know, that their approach is softer. That's sort of the understanding I get from people who I speak to that are younger that study with him. They're like, no, he's kind of a sweetheart. But
Well, Bruce, I think he always has been a sweetheart, right? I think in that way, he's always has been. And maybe the way we, I don't know, I'm not sure how exactly to interpret this, but as we age, we have more perspective and more experience, and then maybe therefore a broader range of ways to put things in category, vocabulary changes. And
God, that's 100% true. And also just, you know, the patience is so,
that's it. Yeah.
It's so different. But do you feel like I don't want to say this new generation, because, you know, every year it's a little different, but you've been teaching there for how long have you been at this college?
I've been at the University of Louisville since 2008.
That's a very long time. So you've gone through, you've had a lot of guitarists go through a lot of kids.
Yeah. Well, you've had one of my former students on, Siad Wells.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Her master's degree here with me. And and I now have, like, for example, I have a student from Costa Rica who is the student of one of my former students. Arturo Calvo is a teacher down there in Costa Rica and has sent along one of his students to audition here. So, I think, you know, in our teaching style, today, I don't know if we can generalize that broadly, but I think there is this generation of educators who were very much about high positivity and empowering students. And there's, mm-hmm. I think, a lot of good that comes out of that. I know at least when I was growing up, I was told you can be whatever you want to be, you know, pursue your dreams and so forth. I think that the caution I would give is to not lose sight of the practical reality that achieving those dreams requires a great deal of work and discipline. And that means that we have to kind of take honest criticism to heart and see how we're going to enact change to improve. So I don't know that I would say that I have one particular approach as far as being harsh with a student or soft with a student or something like that. I usually take it more in stride with where the student is in their development, what their goals are, and how they are personally, how they will react.
That's the art of teaching, is sort of finding the individual, meeting them where they're at, and trying to deal with things in a way that sure is honest to a degree, but not really. The job is to sort of make everybody comfortable and then use that as a point of departure, at least from my experience with the kids. And I know that college kids just aren't that much older and aren't that much more mature. So I can just assume that you have to sort of play into, you know, an ego to an extent and sort of make sure that you're sort of making them feel comfortable, making them feel heard, which is important to everybody.
Well, we've all had, I think, those moments where we're told something and we're not ready to hear it. We don't have the background for it or the foundations for it. And that's, I always try to keep that in mind that, you know, if I have a student who's ready to hear something, I'll tell them. And sometimes I'll preface something like if our lessons have been going along where I'm not particularly harsh with them and it's time to get real and get honest, then I'll kind of set them up for a bit of preparation that's coming. And I'll say, look, this, you have to hear this. And this is why, because it's my job. You know, ultimately we as teachers are failing if all we do is leave our students with the warm and fuzzies and they leave the lesson and have no clue what's going well versus what's not going well.
Right. And then they go to law school. Yeah.
Right. So there are times I definitely have to just lay out the hard and real truth and say, this needs to change and why, but, I try to do it in a pretty calm demeanor.
So you sound like a nice to calm demeanor. Yeah, do it from a place of calm. Like find the place of calm and then deliver the message.
Yeah. And you have to make sure it's heard. So, you know, some of my students tell me just, you know, straightforward that they come from a background. Like I had one student who came from a background of football and he needed a coach and that's what he wanted. And if they need someone that's going to, you know, break pencils and jump up and down and throw chairs and stuff, I'm not that guy. But if they want me to be brutally honest, I will. But I'll be brutally honest and I'll tell them and make sure they do it. But I'm just not going to spend the energy being someone I'm not.
Yeah. It's true that you say that, you know, to sort of say that there's one sort of teaching style is not true. I went from Adam Holzman to Fred Hand and they were night and day, you know.
Right.
In both of them helped in very unique ways.
Oh, exactly.
You know, you were with Gilia, you know, like that's a whole sort of perspective. That's a sort of direct approach and sort of, you know, right to the main line. But so as far as like your performance career, how is that going? You've got, you know, the album from 2016, 2017, then you had a recent album that came out with you featured on it. You're playing a lot of 20th century music. You seem to sort of veer towards the, you know, you're not afraid of some atonality. No. What's going on with your rep and concerts these days?
Well, I played a concert during my festival a couple weekends ago. We have an annual festival here in Louisville in mid-October. And that was the first public performance I'd had since the pandemic of playing a recital. I played a few things that were, you know, online broadcast and streamed and so forth, but not a a formal sit down with a live audience.
How did it feel getting back into it? Was it nerve wracking?
No, exciting. It was nerve wracking in a certain way, of course, of just the nerves of being on stage. But I love it so much that it was just something that I was eager to get to and get going. And I thought, you know, it's crazy to put on a recital during a festival, as anyone who's tried to do that knows. It's just absolutely brutal. But I wanted to do it. So that's where that's going. And then my next recording project is built largely around newer rep. The piece that is on the collaboration album with the Kapinski Duo is a solo guitar piece by my colleague here at the University of Louisville, Mark Satterwhite. It's a piece called Victor Jara's Hands. And
that's what I was listening to, yeah.
Yeah, that's a piece that I'm kind of building the next recording project around. I'm working up Brouwer's Variations on a theme by Victor Jara. And then I've got some other works that in one way or another deal a little bit with this concept of social justice, where Victor Jara was a political activist in Chile during the early 70s. And so I've got some other works that I'm commissioning and bringing back that are works that have been premiered and commissioned prior.
What's your relationship with that story? Can you tell the story of Victor Jara?
Was he
a musician?
Yeah, he was a guitarist, and his work is great to listen to. So he is a poet, a playwright, guitarist, lyricist, songwriter. And my relationship with it is merely that Mark Satterwhite, one of our composition faculty here in Louisville, wanted to write for solo guitar, which he writes really well for the instrument. And he chose the story of Victor Jara for this piece. So Victor Jara was in the early 70s a political activist in Chile before the political coup that came about. Allende, I believe, was the name of the current president. On September 11th, 1973, US CIA-backed military coup came in and overthrew that government. And that's when Pinochet came into power. There's a very good documentary on Netflix about this. And so during that time, they dictated that everyone had to, you know, go back to work and go to their places of employment, whatnot. And Victor Jara went to the university where he taught, and being a political dissident to the new regime, he was rounded up with a bunch of other people, taken to the football stadium there. And was beaten within inches of his life. And knowing that he was a musician, a guitarist, they started first by beating his hands and just breaking every bone in his hands that they could before they finally shot him in the head. And the football stadium is now named after him, Victor Jara. And his message, his songs at the time were those of democracy and love and peace, and the age of the late 60s into the early 70s was one that carried through, and that didn't match up well with what the new regime wanted to say for the country. So they did away with him and many other people, unfortunately. So that piece has some it doesn't borrow from Victor Jara's music. I think Mark was sensitive to the fact.
He sounds like a folk musician, right?
Victor Jara is absolutely right. Yeah. Lovely, lovely tunes, actually. Really, really beautiful.
And the composer is, what's his relationship with Victor Jara?
Mark Satterwhite is the curator for our Grawemeyer Award in Music Composition, which is the world's largest music composition award.
Oh, wow.
That's been awarded annually since 1980. Mark has spent a lot of time in his career in Latin America. And he was in symphonies in Mexico and spent some time in Guatemala, I believe. And so he's fluent in Spanish and very familiar with
the story and with Well, that's cool. And, you know, we're kind of coming to the end here, unfortunately. Sure. Yeah. I know that you're in your office, so somebody's got to be coming through there at some point, right? What do you got going on?
Oh, so before we had this, I taught our weekly lesson of guitar history and literature. Fun.
That's cool.
Yeah. I actually really enjoy teaching those classes.
I've always thought that I never had the opportunity to be a lecturer, but I feel like that would be great. And that's what you get to do, right?
So yeah, absolutely.
And you're teaching the history of guitar. What's your textbook?
We use the Graham Wade as a reference. Everyone in the class uses the Graham Wade Concise History of the Guitar. And obviously that starting the books that are now to print, the Harvey Turnbull Guitar from Renaissance to Present Day. Well, it was present day at the time of publication, which now is, 30 plus years ago. So we use that, and then I supplement with other material, which your podcast is one of the things that we'll be looking at very soon to talk about modern guitarists. Yeah, you are providing a lesson in guitar history, you are. I mean, not that I'm any part of that, but those who you've had on the program.
You're 100% part of that. I mean, you come from a long line, your pedigree. Everything that you put, into sort of your studies and stuff like that is very, it's very solid. So yeah, you're on it. And you're a great guitarist too. I really like that you were talking about speed and how you never thought of yourself as a fast guitarist. It's Louis Tepernier was on too, and he was talking about he has limitations, and I think a lot I do too. Mm-hmm. And it's really sort of it's hard to admit, and it's hard to sort of. But yeah, like you were saying, like you and Dale sort of were able to reconcile that and move forward.
Yeah. I wonder, I don't know Dale's word for it is reconcile that or whatever it might be. But I think one thing that I can get beyond, that maybe I've gotten beyond, is that if you can experience a little bit of ego loss that's associated with maturing, if your goal is to play something at a particular tempo for the purpose of playing at that tempo, I think that's a rather shallow pool of expression.
Yeah.
And if you can recognize what tools you have and seek to convey, as Nick Galousis would say, your vision of artistry through those tools, then you can make something beautiful out of it. And that might mean that you choose your rep around where your abilities lie. And that's fine too.
That's fine too. Not everybody has to play the jigs just constantly.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time, Stephen.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, this has been great. I'm sorry we couldn't have whiskey. It is 1:30. I have to teach children. Otherwise, I would have gotten as drunk as you need me to get. Yeah. But I'm sure that we will one time. Whenever you're in the city, I'm sure we should get together and stuff like that.
Absolutely, we should.
I got to go there too. There's no sense in me not going to Louisville, Kentucky, and seeing those old houses.
You have to come down and see the ponies, see the bourbon.
I didn't even think about the bourbon. Well, bourbon gives me, and it makes my gout flare up a little bit, but
there's got to be a pill for that.
One or two's not a bit. All right, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brett.
That does it for my time with Stephen. I hope you enjoyed it. Happy Thanksgiving, like I said, everybody. Make sure you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support and help out the show. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support, B-R-E-T, Williams, music.com/support. Support me. It's fun. It's great. It's the end of the year. I guess it's a write-off. I'm not sure. Ask your tax person. Bye. Nope, that was a horn. Did you guys hear that? Bye.